Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
G'day, guys. Welcome to another episode. Before we get too far into it, could you please like, subscribe, share, comment, literally anything that you can do. It'll help out a lot. Thank you. All right, welcome back to another episode. And today I'm here with Will Clennett from Clennett Hire. Taking over Melbourne's hire market. But why don't you tell us a little bit? We always start off the same way. A little bit about your story, where you came from, what you did, how you got to sit in that chair, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. Sitting in this chair is a different story, I think, Jimmy. But from Tassie, been in Victoria for a couple of years now. We've got an equipment hire business. We've got four branches in Tassie, one branch in Victoria, North Laverton. We've got about 100 staff and about 3,000 assets under management, and we're just a dry hire business. So access, material handling, civil, lighting, power, and portable building. So we do the lot. We're a general hire company.
Yep. The full hamburger with the lot. If you need to hire stuff, then Clennett Hire's got it, and a few of them. Tell us how you started up Clennett Hire. I think you've got a bit of a backstory. I think people would like to hear about that from down in Tassie too.
I spent my life in building products. So the family business in Tassie historically was in sawmilling and timber yards. So I spent my life cutting my teeth in timber yards and in building products. So I suppose I got to a point in my life where I wanted to do something for myself. I started the business with a business partner. He was a hire guy from Melbourne, mm-hmm. and he came down to Taz and helped me start the business. We started on a gravel yard in a Royal Wolf shipping container, and I don't know, we probably had 50 or 60 assets in our first branch in Hobart, and we just continued to grow.
Was it always the because you're quite big in the access space. I think that from the outsider's perspective, and I don't know fuck all either, so tell me if I'm wrong, but from the outsider's perspective, you started off quite big in the access space, EWPs, work platforms, all of that sort of shit. And then have you branched out from there, or was it everything always at the beginning?
No, look, we probably started life with an access range. Even today, probably 60% of our business, maybe 70% of our business would be access and materials handling.
Yeah, sick. So I'm not a dickhead from what I've noticed then. Great.
No, it's good.
Yeah.
It's
usually good. I can make myself look like a dill.
So maybe 20% of our fleet would be compaction and earth moving.
Okay, yeah. But 20% of 3,000 is still a decent. I don't have to be that good at
it's
math.
It's too many. It's too many.
Like, I'll start adding the numbers. 20% of 3,000 is a lot. And so you were down in Tassie. You had a family business in sawmilling and whatever, and then you went into a gravel Royal Wolf gravel yard with a Royal Wolf container on it and a scissor lift.
Yeah, so I actually stayed. So I was running the family business then, which was a Mitre 10 chain of hardware stores in Taz. And my business partner who'd been started an access business in Victoria. He moved down. We bumped into each other at Christmas one year, and I said, "How'd you like to get back into hire?" And he was on my doorstep 2 or 3 months later, and we had a hire business a couple of months later. So. And I stayed working at Mitre 10 during that period and, sort of had two jobs, if you want to call it that. And so I only joined the business operationally. I mean, I was always involved, but I joined the business operationally about 2 years ago.
Yep. How's that been?
Baptism of fire.
Good.
Yeah, no, it's been good. Coming out of a sort of I had a little stint at a public company before after the family business. And, to be in a accountable for your own outcomes and accountable for your own destiny. I think, that there's the good and bad, but I think you're doing something real and, I think that's what life's about.
Yeah, isn't it? So to follow it along, you've probably hit the trifecta there. You've had the family business where, you know, you're not allowed to headbutt your dad. Then you've had the corporate where, you know, you're not allowed to headbutt anyone. Yeah, you can't even write a nasty email. And now you've gone to your own business, you know, or part of a business that, you know, people headbutt you now.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and you've probably seen all different sides of the spectrum at probably not a small scale either. I think that you undersell yourself a little bit, you know, like you're a successful dude, you know, who has gone from running a very successful chain of hardware stores that everyone knows Mitre 10, you know, like in America, I suppose that you could say that you own like a Lowe's, you know, sort of scale of stuff. You know, you own some Walmart stores, you know, it's not...
Well, I didn't own them, but I ran them.
You get what I mean, small stint at a public company, you know, like...
I think it's good. You get to, you know, I mean, I love what I'm doing. It's got its challenges. Vic's been hard. We'll get into that later. But, you get to sort of bring those skills together and, you know, some of the corporate disciplines and, you know, risk management.
You think it helps sometimes? You think it helps or you think it hinders?
I think in the corporate environment it can be challenging at times to get things done, but, you know, capital is easy. You learn how to scale a business. You learn about spans of control. You learn about, you know, managing people and, you know, executing efficiently. But... then some things are also really tough because there's a lot of rules.
Yeah.
You get to bring all that together now, and I like to think Clennett Hires sort of reflects the essence of a real family business. But you know, we're operating and competing, you know, predominantly in infrastructure. So in Victoria, 70% of our market is infrastructure projects. So Westgate Tunnel, for instance, probably been a big part of our revenue over the last sort of 2 years. Where was I?
You're up to scaling and bringing in the corporate on one side, family on the other side. I find one of the challenges that I have with it is that as I'm trying to scale from a dude who was digging holes in a backyard, right? Like I started off digging holes in backyards for, you know, a plumber. That then I've gone and moved into the let's say the infrastructure space, which is probably the highest that you can get to, maybe, you know, on par with mining. One might be above in some areas, whatever it is. But it's about as high as you can get. Like you've left backyards a long time ago, and your output needs to be different when you're on a job like that. And you're coming at it probably from... They want to be able to deal with the boss, or they want to be able to call you out at a Westgate Tunnel project, you know, to really have you be able to flex the companies, you know, operationally to get them a boom in 2 hours.
Yeah, I like infrastructure because it's harder work, so not everyone wants to do it. As you know the compliance, everything's got to be uploaded, machines have got to be inducted. There's insurances, there's capability statements. It's a lot of paperwork, but in some respects it puts us in a smaller pen. So, you know, we're competing.
Do you think it does though? Because I don't know, I've seen there's a few, there's a website that you can build a capability statement in 7 seconds that it pulls your pictures off of now.
ChatGPT's pretty good thing.
And then now you have, these guys putting out, which, you know, if there's any listening, hello, but, you know, we will get you your ISOs in 2 minutes and 30 seconds if you pay us $10,000. And you go...
I wish I knew about that when we did it.
Fuck, I wish I knew. I'm about to go for my my re-accreditation with it. You know how you've got the...
Annual.
Now you've got the 3 year, so every third year you have to redo the whole lot, and then every second year... You maintain it or something?
Yeah, okay.
I don't know.
I think it's an annual audit.
Yeah, annual audit, and then every third one's a bigger audit.
Yeah, right.
Just to screw you up a little.
Well, I reckon we're at year 2 or 3, so that must be
coming. Yeah, welcome. It's coming. So every third year I think your ISOs have to have. But who tells you that? You know, like you go and you say, oh, I'm going to get my ISO accreditation, and then you bring the auditors in, and you know, you bring in someone to help you, and they start, oh, you need this system and that system and blah, blah, blah. And then you get it and you go, what do I do with this now?
Yeah, it's the maintenance of those things that are hard. But if you know, in some respects it feels over the top, but if you can actually just live and breathe it every day, you're match fit. know.
Yeah, that's what I ended up finding with my stuff because for the first time when I got it, I got it for a job because I needed it. And, you know, like I probably pushed the envelope around getting it, putting the cart before the horse, if you will, you know, saying I will run to these rules once I have them, but I sort of need the piece of paper before I get there. It was probably a decade ago now, though. And it was really hard. That first audit, they came back. It was really tough because you just can't get the policy and put them in on a shelf and then pull them out 1 year later for your audit. It's
grueling.
It's really hard. So then I got on a new safety girl, you know, probably about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, and instead of having this yearly struggle, you know, as we're moving more into it, we just went, nah, we just do the whole lot. For every single day, we just run what the systems are meant to be. We make the boys and girls accountable for what they're meant to do out at the factory or in the yard or on site or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's probably the change we've had. I mean, we brought in a gun. We had a really senior WH&S and compliance officer who wrote the policies, and it was almost like having the safety police in the business. You know, when the audit was on, the branch would get notified and, you know, a team would sort of come in and get it ready. And, I think we've sort of moved on from that now, and, you know, our operational staff live and breathe and complete activities.
I think
activities,
that you could, you know, audit me next week and I'd be right. I think that's the main part about it. When 7-8 years ago, if you audited me, in a week, I'll be in deep shit. I'll be in deep shit. And I think that people have to be real about that sort of stuff as well. Like, companies change and companies grow and everything else like that. And, you know, it's not quite as easy as some people make it sound, but then it's far more difficult than other people make it sound as well, you know, to do it properly.
Yeah, I think it's overwhelming at first, but it's, you know, it's common sense.
So how'd you go from when you were down in Tassie, you were running some Mitre 10 stores. What did your old boy do? Did your old boy worked in them?
He'd been in them all his life. So we had a couple of shops when I joined. He was still involved, but fortunately there was a general manager before me and a CEO before me. So it wasn't I wasn't sort of punching up Dad in the timber yard. So in some respects, you know, I had to earn my stripes. It was a tough environment. You know, it was like John's son. I don't think anyone was too thrilled when I arrived. But over time, I sort of, you earn your stripes. Yeah. You get your runs on the board. You put your head down. You know, so that process took a few years. I was in that business for 12 years.
Shit.
And then, you know, probably for the last 5 years of that, I was the CEO. And we went on a pretty exciting journey because, as you know, Bunnings is a ferocious beast, and so we found ourselves having these massive green boxes opening across the road, and that'd gut your business 40% overnight. You know, I remember one store lost $8 million in cash sales overnight, gone. First time we had a Bunnings open across the road from us. So
you're joking? Like, it just
gone. And you put a heap of stuff in place and you're active, you've got pro, mate, you just, you know, there's only so much household spending in hardware. And so,
hold off on the ISO meetings for a minute. We've got a real, give us back the boardroom.
interestingly, actually that first one, we fought pretty hard in court, through Kingborough Region Development Association that we established, and we held him up for 15 months, and finally the board and Dad said, you got to stop this shit. You know, you've been fighting them for forever.
And yeah, but you're burning money in one hand.
Well, we'd probably spent $500,000 on legals, and but then the month they opened, we lost $260,000 that month. So. In hindsight, could have kept the court case running for a bit longer.
Yeah, but hindsight's always 20/20. Sometimes out the windshield, she isn't quite as quite as crystal clear.
That's not the real outcome from that is we had to sit down and go, what's our place in this market? And we largely got onto cheaper real estate. We got out of the big box hardware environment, big nursery, and scaled it back to a tight range of attachment products that go with trade timber and fibre cement.
Perfect.
We produce drive through, you know, Timber Yards. We had a business, you know, a model very similar to a Bowens format, if you, for people that are familiar with that in Victoria. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got into frame and truss manufacturing. We went heavier into residential building products, and we ended up with a better business as a result of that.
So who was the main driving force behind that? Because that's really interesting, that part there is because you sit down and you go, right, like, you know, like that. That's like there's a natural disaster that's happened to your business. You know, like you said, the big green boxes came on. Like that. That could be destroy. That could destroy a, you know, a chain of stores in.
And it did all around the country.
Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping.
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, nice, the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
In a matter of 6-12 months, like if they come into your area and they go plonk, 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 and then you're fucked. You seem to have pivoted fairly well from that. And has that landed you in a way that Clennant Hire is able to, you know, look at a market, try and dive into what you're really after? Because that's something I think I've done. So what, like my company... Everyone started taking on all of these scope items. You know, everyone started doing concrete and retaining walls and plumbing and fuck. You know, you start out digging and now all of a sudden you're doing stormwater and a car park and then you're doing a high-rise building, you know. Like, and I said, no, I'm not going to do any of that. I just want to move the dirt, right? Just give me the dirt. I'll price that component of what I do a million different ways. Hours, tons, cubes, days, months. I couldn't give a fuck, but that's what I do. I don't want anything to do with any concrete. I don't want anything to do with that. It sort of seems like, and that's held me in fairly good stead, you know, in the time as all of these companies have scaled and then, you know, it's like boom or bust, you know, sort of style. I've just ticked along, you know, now we move a lot of dirt, but I've ticked along, you know, on my niche, doing what I do, you know. And then, of course, there's always challenges. But did you find that now? Did you sit down with Clennant and say, okay, I'm going to do that? Or did you come at it from the other point and you're like, fuck yeah, let's get it done?
Yeah, look, I mean, going back to your earlier question, yeah, we weren't that smart. I mean, you know, it's a great story to say you pivoted to trade. It was kind of all that was left after Bunnings were done with us. And, you know, but, you know, we came to realise really what was a big part of our business. It's a relationship business. You don't need to be, you know, running huge TV campaigns and selling pallets of Omo. You know, we sort of, you know, that what was left was trade. And if you're willing to work harder and run trucks and, you know, pick stock and, you know, it's a harder game. I don't think Bunnings are that sincere about really owning that market. I think if they wanted to,
do they even have to? Like, they sit down and get like enough. You know, between the Block television show and I don't know, whatever Backyard Blitz is, everyone's a handyman on the weekend that goes down and buys a Ryobi circular saw on a Saturday.
They're making a fortune. I think, you know, they make sort of profit $1.5 billion on $8 billion or something, which is not bad. I mean, so I used to think they were 90% retail, 10% trade. We were 90% trade, 10% retail.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's where, so in terms of Clennant Hire, no, you'd like to think you learn from the mistakes of the past. I think, you know, we kind of went into everything in Clennant Hire, and Tassie's been a really different market to Vic. I probably had quite long-term relationships in Tas. The brand was more recognisable. The family business was called Clennant's Mitre 10, so Clennant Hire, you know.
Just makes sense.
I'd been in the game for a long time. You know, we had relationships. You know, when we got into earth moving, old family friends of ours, the Hazel brother family. So we had
some, Richard Hazel very well. I think me and you have sent a photo of each other one afternoon to him and said, g'day, he's a great bloke.
I think he's on the Gold Coast now, I think.
He's moving around a little bit,
He's a year below me at school.
Shit. What I find really interesting is how you said, you know, like it sounds really smart. It also sounds really smart that I stuck to my thing moving dirt. But one of the reasons why I stuck to my thing moving to dirt is fuck, I sucked at organising car parks. Like I'm so shit at car parks. So yeah. Like we sort of step outside our box a little bit and then we get whacked so hard, you know. Like, yeah, I'll JV with a guy and we'll put in some pipe. And then all of a sudden, this is a true story, that the guy went away, he had a mental moment, and he went away for a month to Bali, and I had to put the pipe in the ground. I lost that much money. I was fucking putting money in the bin. Yeah. And then I come now on a podcast, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years later, and sit down and say, we only stick to what we know. We've got our niche. Yeah, nah, we're forgetting about the pipe in the ground story that I think I dumped like 20 grand or 30 grand. When 20 grand or 30 grand was everything I had, yeah. Like I had to pull back out the pipe. I had to do all of that just because some guy, like, and that's probably where you need things to go right for you as well, you know, like those pivotal moments when things can go right or wrong, like a successful business can just go right, you know?
Oh, 100%. I think you've just got to continue to adapt. I mean, you know, you're better to take small shots everywhere, and once you find what works, you know, start loading the cannonballs. So I think, you know, for us now, you know, we've got two different businesses, Vic and Taz. So Taz has got a nice geography. Each branch is sort of in the major region about 100 k's apart. So we're in Hobart, Devonport, Lonnie, and our latest branch, which we opened this year, which is in Bell Bay, which is sort of a big industrial hub.
Bell Bay.
Yeah, Georgetown.
It's, no one's ever heard of that. Not one person on this podcast is going to sit down and go Bell Bay.
Bell Bay, it's got a big deep port, and it's got Tempco, which is that, you know, steel business, Rio Tinto. There's probably only about 6 customers there. Oh, but they're all,
when you start mentioning Rio Tinto as a customer, it's like...
And I think they're there because it's got this deep port facility and they're processing materials and doing things. But
yeah,
it's,
I'm sure there's smarter men than me and you sitting in a room deciding, well, like, you know, if Bell Bay's the option, then that's where they're going.
Yeah, yeah. The Taz government are planning on building a $2 billion hydrogen plant in Bell Bay, so... one of the many reasons we went, but...
Is that off of the ground yet or not yet?
Bell Bay?
No, hydrogen.
Oh, they're doing the demolition now. Just completed the demolition. So it's not approved. It's a political football in Taz, just like the footy stadium is. But, I'd like to think it would get there. Yeah.
Now, let's get on to Melbourne. The market in Melbourne. Now, me and you have had lots of discussions on this over the time. It's hard to pinpoint a number. It's also hard to pinpoint, like, exactly, you know, what's going to happen. You know, we have politicians promising, what seems to be a ludicrous number of houses per year, but yet every housing developer I know putting in a permit can't get one. The infrastructure market seems to have had the rug pulled out a little bit from it, you know, just in terms of we ran from level crossing to MRPV job to then the mega projects, the North East Link, Westgate Tunnel, Suburban Rail. You know, we had these mega ones on top of that. Well, fuck, it doesn't seem like there's much really cracking.
A lot of those projects have been very slow to get going. So obviously the Westgate's coming to an end. I think they're going to have the road open on the 15th of November.
That's what they say.
Apparently it's quite significant penalties. I won't say what they are.
Do they ever even pay them? Like, honestly, come on. Oh. Like, you know, these consortiums sometimes, and mind you, I don't think we could deliver the projects that we have in Melbourne without them.
No.
So I don't think, and I think that the business model that they created with a shared pain, shared gain, whatever the fuck it is that they do, that's quite good too, and then they manage quite well with some of the MRPV jobs. However, like some of these numbers, you got CPB in New South Wales that they're having that big fight over the tunnels.
Yeah.
On a design and construct job that they've said, nah, we didn't design it to be able to construct it, and now we need, like, it feels like Dr. Evil $1 billion to fix it.
That dirt's always very contaminated.
Then you've got the contaminated problem altogether. But where do you see it happening? We spoke yesterday or last week on the phone about the subdivisions.
It's a market of a few stories, I think. I was only looked it up last night, but I think we need to be building about 60,000 homes a year in Victoria to meet the the demand, and I think we're at sort of 48,000. So, and that also includes all dwellings. So that's a lot of these build to rent, a lot of those, you know, smaller, you know, build to lease apartments in the city, going to that number. So, you know, I haven't got detached housing numbers, but it's down. I mean, we had, you know, customers that did subdivision earth moving work, and you know, some of them are reporting they're 30-40% down. So residential housing market's a disaster. That's not our main bread and butter, but it's kind of the heartland of how trades are performing how the market's going, I think. And, you know, it's a huge employment sector. Those people have small families. They buy homes. It's, you know, it hurts the economy, I think, when housing's
At some point, though, like the Australian economy is either built on mining or the housing. I don't think we'd necessarily get to see the flow down effect from mining very much. By the time it gets to us, it's probably pennies on a dollar. However, we do see the increase, you know, in housing, whether it's, you know, through immigration or through population, you know, whatever it might be. However, we need more houses, but it doesn't seem like we can build them.
Well, I think like the planning rules in Vic were designed around these metro stations and the train line networks and increasing density of housing in those areas.
I think the other day that said we are one of the least dense. You know, I could make some jokes here because I've met some pretty dense people in Melbourne. However, we're one of the least dense population. Like, we're lower than Los Angeles and let alone an Asian country where they have a billion high-rises, you know.
Yeah. I reckon in a couple of years we'll be banging out houses in the suburbs like there's no tomorrow, you know.
In the outer suburbs, like where they have been?
Out west, out north, yeah. I just don't think it's been – I mean, I think out west is sort of 25% of the population. It's about 25% of the housing starts. I'm not sure that we're getting the housing supply based on the current framework. So,
but they're also not selling. If you look at the market and how much they are, so like it's got to be just a straight up market at some point that says when the interest rates are low and when we can, you know, buy, you know, because of the banks aren't making record profits or whatever it might be, you know, like. When they can buy, people will build. Like, there's people sitting on stock waiting because they've also got 100 houses or lots that haven't sold yet.
Life was a bit better when interest rates were 3%.
Fuck, wasn't it ever? Life was a lot better when interest rates were 3%. I bought a block of land and I bought it when it was 3% and I settled on it a year later when the interest rates had gone like 6% or something, 7%.
I can't remember the numbers, but I was on a fixed rate home loan in Tassie of sort of, I don't know, 2.5% or 3%. And I sold the house when I moved to Melbourne, but if I'd have kept that house, I can't remember the numbers. If I'd have kept that house, I wouldn't have been able to afford it. A year later, after those rates came off, my repayments would have doubled.
But so they ended up on this block of land that I bought. They ended up saying to me, I cried poor. Like, I was real upset. Like, I was dirty too, because they also changed around all the LVR rubbish that banks like to do, you know. They change around all the bullshit. And I went there and I'm like, it is more than double. Like, it is more than double what I have to pay compared to when I signed up. Like, and I can't afford it. And they said, yes, you can. And I said, that's not the point. In my brain, I can't afford it. Yeah, like, and I think that that's where the banks, like, and I'm certain you've had a lot to deal with the banks. They sometimes can be your biggest friend, but sometimes can absolutely get every last drop from you, you know, in business. It's quite a challenge to deal with them, you know.
I've got a really good CFO that I brought into the business last year. In hindsight, it should have been one of the first things I did.
Yep.
Just made us more data-led, you know, improved our banking relationships. But, you know, in all honesty, the bank's been pretty good to us. And, you know, obviously COVID and the aftermath of that, we've had good support. But, you know, I think it's always important to share your problems and, you know, be up front and show up.
Showing up's very important. I think that a lot of people miss that sort of that thing where they sit down and build in relationships, whether it's at, like, I think the industry is a relationship-based game. So it also, where a tech guy might not think it's important, he just might think that, you know, you send letters to the bank and that might be fine. Like, as a construction industry person, it's all about relationships. I'm sure you found that moving over to Melbourne from Tassie. Did you find that there was a difference in the market, apart from, of course, the work?
I think for us, it just, for me and the business here, it's just taken time to build relationships. It's not something that happens in 5 minutes. So you go out and sort of acquire customers. You need to start trading with people to in turn build a relationship, and you know, you just maybe 30% of those customers you wish you didn't acquire when you got here. But, that's all part of it. So it's a different game. I think you've really got to know who you're dealing with here, and you've got to want to choose good customers and put the effort in. You don't want to take everything that comes in the door, which is different in Taz. It's a country town. Everyone knows everyone.
That's what I – like, how do you find it's different in doing business between, you know, let's say – oh, we could call it, you know, lean into what we were saying before, the more corporate Melbourne, you know, on these huge mega projects and these huge, tenders, compared to your family sort of orientated business down in Tassie. Not trying to undersell Tassie at all either.
Oh, the scale of everything's really different. Like, you know, we used to have a cowbell in the sales office, and I don't know, if there was a $3 million job on, you know, total construction value in Tassie at a period of time, you know, we'd be ringing the cowbell to get some LVLs on there or something. But and that's changed. There's $80 million jobs there now, and there's a few big, there's some large infrastructure jobs touted that have sort of, you know, nearly a billion.
There's been some big bridges be built and a few other
Bridgewater Bridge. But you still can't compare Bridgewater Bridge to the Westgate Tunnel. I mean, they would have had... the Westgate might have had 2,500 pieces of hired implant on that project. When it was raging, we didn't have that many on there. But it's just a different kettle of fish, really.
Is it completely different, or can you?
No. The fundamentals of business and people, I think, are always the same. The challenge here, if you really want to focus on the major projects, is it just takes time to get in there. It's like you can't just rock up to Jimmy's office and drop your card off. You can't walk onto the site. It's a big compound, so it just takes time to nurture relationships. One of the good things about these consortiums that build these big projects is when the project's over, they effectively dissolve the consortium. So those sort of key leads and project managers find themselves then at the airport or the North East Link, and so
if
you've supported Nightworks and you've answered your phone, you've done stuff on a Saturday, and you've done a bit of free cartage when they need to shift stuff around, those things will hold you in good stead.
Strange that the same sort of business, you called them fundamental, so I'll steal that so I sound smart. Isn't it strange the same business fundamentals matter whether you're in a small store in a town no one's ever heard of in Tasmania, or you're at the biggest project that was in Australia's history at the time, you know, spend-wise. That was before all the blowouts, I think. But it's the same. Look after the people who look after you, you know, and then hopefully that you make their job easier to do by calling Clinton Hire, and they make your business viable because of that phone ringing. That's really hard to sometimes translate to employees as well, to sit down and go, well, you know, like, I understand it's a 7 to 5 job or a 7 to 3 or whatever, or whatever your times are, but then what happens at night work? You know, how do we go down there? We try and put in place all of the systems on the way through. However, they want to talk to Will, and it's fucking 10 p.m. at night. Guess what?
I had a bit of an embarrassing moment. We picked up some night works for a tunnel shut maintenance contract, or a part of it, and we didn't answer the phone. At sort of 2 in the morning, and I had to go down there and get dragged over the hole, dragged over the coals, and they more or less were like, "Well, how does your system work?" And I was like, "Look at." The business probably, outgrown the system. We just had an honest system. Every 16 weeks, you got the mobile phone for night shift, and we've had to yeah, we've had to upgrade that policy and change the way we do things. But felt a bit embarrassed explaining it after we hadn't answered the phone. But they were forgiving, and we made a commitment that
I've had some times when I'm certain people listening know all about the trucking market and the challenges around playing around with that, you know, like what it is, the subcontractor pool and everything. So I had a job. We took on our scope. They added additional scope. That's what ended up happening. I couldn't facilitate the additional scope. However, it's my job to provide trucks for the project. If the project needs 10 and I've signed on for 10 and then they want 30, well, they still want us to give the other 20.
Yeah.
And if you can't do it, you're on the coals and explaining why. You know, I have one, let's say that 10 goes into 30 and I got 26. Well, 26 ain't fucking 30. We need 30 here. And you go, but please, I did so good. I've got like, you know.
Just ring me next time that happens to me.
Far out. I was in so, and I can still remember it. It was a fair few years ago now, this one. And like they came to me and they said, you know, like we need you to get this done. And I said, well, okay. I'll go close. And then when, let's say it was 26 out of 30, they rung up and they're like, you didn't get it done. And you go, but that's what a good business is, yeah? Like the fundamental says you must answer at night.
You're going to make mistakes. I think, you know, and I think it's important to call that out. You know, you've got nothing at the end of the day, you know, if you're not, you know, if you can't sort of acknowledge that, and you'll have problems with customers. And you always say to the team, you know, when we're in the shit, you know, never waste a crisis. So, you know, sometimes most of the time, I think you walk away with a better and stronger relationship.
A more robust relationship, you know. Yeah. It doesn't matter what it is with your employees as well.
Exchanging a few words. I mean, by the end of it, you've just moved into like the real territory, and you're starting to get an understanding for each other. And, you know, if you seek to act fairly, you're going to learn about the other person pretty quickly. And,
and it's also what you put in. Like, it's also how you own it. The next time they called on night shift, did you answer the phone? Fuck yeah, I did, you know, because I don't want to lose the job. When they asked me for more trucks the next time, did I get it or say no? Of course I did. By the way, just in case for the viewers at home, we got it covered. We got, I think it was, let's say 33 there. But it was the induction process, like what you were talking about before. Like, you know, if they've ordered 10 booms and then they say, shit, we can't use the scissors that we have and we have to upgrade and, you know, put them all as booms and we need 30 in 2 days, you go, poor, I don't know, can we run an induction? And they go, no. We expect you to have them. And you go, guys, that's a, you know, sort of asking for a lot here and I don't want to say no. And fuck, that still burns me not getting that done, eh?
Well, one of the things I've always found hard about equipment hire, it's interesting, and it's probably the capacity point you're talking about. You know, when you're selling timber or steel, just however many metres, however many tonne they want, you just keep buying it and you supply it. Now, you know, you might have some delays, but it's an endless supply product, effectively. Equipment game's hard because you can do a lot of work, you can win a tender, but you're tendering for everything. And so when the day comes or the month comes and they want the stock, you might not have it. And that's one of the most disappointing aspects of being in this business. And you're not able to take on projects because you haven't got the gear.
So we got a tender at the moment. It might actually, we'll talk about it off air once we're done here. But we got a tender at the moment that we won, and you know we say to them, oh, can we just get any sort of histogram with anything you want? Because the same thing, we've won it from, let's say, 5 ton to 50 ton, I mean, the dozers and graders and candlestick makers and a butcher in the corner if they want some fresh meat. We've won the whole lot. What do you need? Oh, we don't know. Well, do you know anything of what you need? Because we have to spend a lot of money getting the gear ready, you know. Plus, mind you, they need an external weed and seed that's done by their person that takes 1 to 2 weeks to book in. And you go, okay, well, that's all good, but how the fuck are we going to land on the job on, like, on a Tuesday when you call me on the week before and say, hey, listen, so we need that 35, 25, 20, 15 and a Positrack here, please, next week. And you go, yeah, nah, it's not going to happen. And then they go, well, oh, can't supply.
Yeah.
And you go, no, I can. I just need just this much information to supply, please. But that's the game. And when you said the barrier to entry about the safety, the barrier to entry about machine, you know, inductions or safety or whatever, that's another one of the barriers, you know, how, you know.
Well, capital is also a finite resource. You're not necessarily going to go out and buy three more machines just because you need them for 3 months, you know. It's got to make sense.
Capital is a finite resource. I'm going to put that on above some people's heads in my office. You know, but no, very true, because like, and you can't go out and buy, because on some of these jobs, what would it be? It'd be 10 grand, 20 grand to get it onto a job. I know that's the number it is on the trucks. It's about 15-ish grand for a truck and trailer to have all of the top-notch safety.
Oh, the additional spec? Yeah, it's, I think we sort of look at it in percentage terms, but it's considerable.
Like, yeah, it's not a zero line item. It's not like you put a sticker kit on it.
No, you're paying 10% more, or you know, you're probably paying anywhere from 5 to 10% more for a mining spec. So we're a full mining spec, or they call it here a tier one spec.
Tier one spec, yeah. We ask for our builds to be done tier one spec, and no one knows what it is half of the time, and you end up getting getting your auto elect to come and spend a day per machine to change a beep to a buzz and to change a, you know, make a horn go off if, I don't know, they press the up-down button twice or some shit like that. So to loop back around, we were talking about the market in Vic, but then I got sidetracked because that's just...
Started talking about that, your argument with the bank when you bought a house.
Yeah, the bank anyway. Where do you think the Vic market's going? Where do you think that the next big things are going to be? Like, we owe a lot of money. We are not building any houses. So what's your idea?
Oh, look, I'm not an economist, but I think for us, in terms of where our attention is, so obviously those large infrastructure projects we were talking about before, so M80 road widening, Northeast Link, Suburban Rail Loop, they're obviously a large long-term priority for us. There's about 9 projects of significance that we're chasing that are probably all as big as the Westgate. But data centres have been the flavour of the month for a couple of years, and there's a reasonable round of those coming out of the ground, and those things eat equipment like the mechanical contracts, the plastering, electrical.
Gosh, they take some EWPs out there. Like, they would take that many, it seems like. And if you go inside them, like the fit-outs of what they're actually doing, it's like you can barely drive. You know, I've seen them. They're stacked like this with guys working up in the roof. Yeah.
So that's like access heaven. So they're big priorities for us. There's about 12 data centres that are coming out of the ground now, and they just keep getting bigger. Some of them are, you know, billion-dollar data centres in their own right. So, I think the bread and butter for access companies in Vic historically has been distribution centres going up in Derrimut and Truganina, and that market hasn't been what it was. And I think that, again, just build cost is high, money's expensive, things aren't stacking up, but still think Victorian land's cheap out west compared to, you know, Sydney, and it's still a very good distribution point where, you know, you can carton to South Australia, you can carton to Sydney. And so I think that market will come back. It's just a matter of when it does. And so for us, that's, you know, I think that's really the underbelly of you know, Victorian commercial construction from an access. Well, and
I've definitely noticed that some of the things have dropped off, and it seems like if you're not in a data center or something like that, then there isn't as much industrial sort of shit happening for sure.
It's tough. I mean, I've got, you know, competitors that we're close with, and we've got to work with some people.
Of course,
and
you have to work with someone.
Yeah, a lot of people are reporting businesses similar to ours are down 15-20%. So, you know, on prior year's trading, so that's a tough environment to be.
But if you were to talk to some, you know, industry groups or whatever else, like, and they all come and say, oh, no, it's okay, the building industry is still plugging away. I don't know where the fuck they get their numbers from. But I read one the other day that said we've increased the amount of dwellings that we're putting out compared to 3 years ago, and that means that there's more work. Mm. And the connection, the dots that they were connecting were just like, you know, it was ridiculous, because from 3 years ago to now, 3 years ago was COVID, you know, and all of that sort of stuff. So all of their metrics were skewed when on the ground, you know, you're sending out a bit less equipment, I'm sending out less equipment. You know, there's the market has definitely shrunk in some points. I don't know what the percentage is. Who would know? Now, I did want to talk about one last thing with you here, and it's a nice little point to segue. You've built some teams. You helped build a family team, then you moved and helped be in charge of a corporate team, and now you've built another team at Clennett Hire, and I'd like to pick your brain a little bit about that and how you do it and how you find 18 players to play on your team and how do you keep them?
I think that's always been the part I enjoy the most. It obviously comes with challenges, people. But, you know, if I think back to the family business, we built a fantastic team, dragged a lot of them out of footy clubs.
Is that where you find good ones, a footy club?
Yeah. A couple of soccer clubs. But, yeah, sporting teams are always good. It's out of industry. But I think you got to get out of your seat and you got to go and find people. I've never had great success on advertising platforms. I think if you want a good driver, you want a good sales rep, find out who they are, talk to your customers, pick the phone up and ring them. That environment in corporate land at Metcash was different. We had great people, but you just weren't as nimble, and there were rules and procedural fairness, and you know, you had to run processes, which is all valid. But when it's your money and your own business, you can cut through a bit of that and do what you think's right, because you have to, right? You got to pay the bills and you need to get the results. So Clennett Hire has been great because it's, you know, probably had some of the corporate learning now, but, we do things properly, but you can get back out and pick the phone up and bring people into your business. And, yeah, we've had a lot of growth in Vic. It hasn't been without its challenges, but, you know, we've got some really committed individuals. I mean, we talked before about, you know, me being available and night calls. I've got a small army of people that would give the shirt off their back for what we're trying to do in the market. So
I say that similar. Like I'm very lucky. We'll call them a committed group of core individuals that would answer the phone. But I've got a committed group of core individuals. You cut them open and a Starbucks sticker pops out their vein. They love Starbucks. And what they've built and how they've built it and the team that they've made, which, like, I like to call myself the leader, but sometimes I'm the guy shoveling the shit in the corner, because they know what they're doing more than I do.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And they care about it and love it more than I do. You know, where people rocking up, it was only a month ago I had someone rock up at a job and stay there for a night shift on a weekend because they thought that I needed someone. And you go, I'll make sure to pay you for one. Yeah, like that goes without saying. But you can't teach that. You can't employ that. You can't find that. You know, like the people who with the buy-in.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm certain you've got the similar sort of things.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We're an incredibly committed group, and I always like it when you're trying to get involved in something and someone says, "Hey, you know, piss off! I've got this." And you look them in the eye and you're like, "Well, do you understand what we're trying to?" And they're like,
No, but seriously, that's twice you've asked me now.
Like, okay, fine. You know, I mean, that's the best, right? Give people a purpose statement and let them run it like it's their own.
Well, I think I've really struggled throughout the years. I've ebbed and flowed of having these great teams and this great culture, you know, where, you know, people will it's not just about how much they work or what you're getting out of them either. But at some point, that's a measurable thing. So you can say, you know, they work so hard and everything else. But really, you know, the culture, the fabric of the company has been so strong. In other times, the culture's been real shit. And the management of that and to try and fix that, it can be really challenging with people. How did you go about it? We'll look back. You know, the culture when Bunnings opened up next door in Minor 10 wouldn't have been the best I can't imagine that it would have been. How did you manage that sort of thing?
No, yeah. No, that, yeah, that was a terrible time. I think we did 26 redundancies almost in a group setting. You know, I'd be on a few people's dartboards. As I said, times were it was an emergency. I don't know. I've sort of got a culture gets talked about a lot, and you want a great culture, and there's no easy answers. I think a couple of rules for me. My dad always used to say the bad ones come no cheaper. But if you've got people that are poisonous to your culture, like you can have one of them. You get two of them together, it spreads like cancer. You got to have them. I think sometimes building a culture is about defining what you're not willing to accept and being clear on that. I think as leaders, you've got to. It's walking by management, management by walking about. You got to be in your business. You got to work in your business. And, I wouldn't say – I think there'd be pockets of our business, different branches, different teams where, it's all rosy and it's always – it's always two steps forward, one step backwards and you got to stay committed to building a good culture.
It definitely feels that way sometimes. And I don't think that even if you got, let's say, let's say someone came in and scored your culture and you got a 10 out of 10 culture. That doesn't mean that next week you don't have Melissa fighting with Jane, that then Jane is friends with Ash or Andrew, and then Andrew gets involved and whatever happens, and it doesn't even have to be a fight. It can just be that, they don't like something on the weekend. Who knows? And those little moments can change your score of 10 2 weeks ago at culture to 7, 8, 6, 5, 4. And then all of a sudden someone else has quit because they can't be fucking dealing with this. And then the fabric has changed. It's almost like it's just this thing that has to be constantly looked at and constantly monitored, for good and bad. And I do find that one of the things that's that impacts culture probably more than anything else is that if you're busy and business is going good, business is going great, when everyone's got something on.
When you've got plenty of resource, and there's work everywhere, it's easy to be generous and have a good time.
I spoke about it the other day. We had our worst day for a while on a Monday a few weeks back, and it just so happened, or maybe a couple of months ago now, it just so happened that we took the sales team out on a dinner on the Friday, then the Monday was shit, and you go, what do they ask, causation or correlation or whatever it is? I don't know, something, someone real smart.
There's
said
a correlation.
Something. I don't have to be a fuckwit, but everyone left work an hour early, went and got a haircut, went and got a blow-dry done, and we go out, and then Monday's shit. And that's okay too, but it's only okay this time because next time we're not doing nothing again if it happens, can't have the worst day.
It's like that. Party hard, play harder. I think if you've got a Friday night function, you've got to show up on Monday. That's it. Maybe you take an early minute. You need to be flexible with people. But if you have the Friday night, you got to show up on Monday.
Well, that's the acceptable part, we're talking about. That's like, I think that one of the things that about leading a great team is to make them accountable to a standard, and that standard might be work hard, party harder, or vice versa or whatever. But Monday morning, you're here, you're turned up and your shit's sorted, because what do you do?
Yeah.
Because you can't shut down doing a Friday night function. That's not right either for the people who are turning up. It was like almost crickets on Monday morning. And you don't really want to make too big of a deal about it, but also at the same time, you need everyone to know that the line is just there,
How do Christmas parties go at Starbucks?
Well, Christmas parties, actually, that you mentioned that... we had at some points about 3-4 years ago, we could have 300 or 400 people at a Christmas party. And we had some antisocial behaviour, minding my P's and Q's, of course, for people. And actually, it was probably 5 or 6 years ago now. Like, we were cranking, our business was busy, making plenty. Antisocial behaviour and some pretty bad antisocial behaviour. So I changed it, and now we do family day in the park. And we do family day in the park, and everyone comes, and we have a Santa Claus come and give presents to kids and everything like that, and, you know, food trucks everywhere, which, mind you, food truck business, that's a they can make some money, those blokes.
100%.
Or $3,500 for a guy to come and make coffee one year. I couldn't believe it.
I used to get Mr. Burger to come to construction sites in Tassie years ago, and it was expensive, but it's popular.
Very popular. You know, please
can't afford it anymore.
Please get a piece of access equipment with your burger. Thank you. Every burger comes with an order form. You know, X here, Y here. So we stopped doing the Christmas parties where, you know, everyone.
It's a challenge to get right.
We had it in the yard. It was the first year I had it in the yard. I had it all set up, and everyone turned into a dickhead, like a big dickhead. Just stupid behaviour. And I sat down and I said, "This is just not gonna. This is not gonna fight. This isn't the company I want either." And everyone then came. Half of them came on Monday and after the Christmas party and said that was the best Christmas party ever. And then the other half
was it punch ups or
There was punch ups and there was hooning and there was you go like, what do you do?
We ended up at a mechanical bull place in Footscray, I think, this year. And
any good?
No, it was good. Yeah, there was a few dramas, but same thing. I think we might try the family day.
Family day, give presents for the kids. All of the kids come down. We give out a whole heap of merchandise. We've had excavator rides and all sorts of stuff for people that we've put together safely, of course. We can't, you know, let the powers that be know that they need to come and shut down a Christmas function, but... You know, we had it all set up so kids could get a ride on the excavator with someone.
I like that.
You know, and kids actually love it.
On excavator rides, I've always wanted to rent one of the large scissor lifts to like a music festival and set it up as a kissing booth so people could enter from either side of the machine, you know, blind, and then get in and you lift them up while everyone's cheering on it. So I've pitched it to a few festival organisers. No one's taken me up on
it. Not once.
Dark mofo. I don't know if you heard of Mona in Tassie, but, you know, that's what something that really was the goose that laid the golden egg. It's this $350 million museum that's built by a guy called David Walsh. Worth looking it up if you don't know about Mona. Anyway, they have a big winter festival every year, and they were letting fireworks off a boom lift this year. So it was some cool pictures online.
One step closer to... a kissing booth on top of a elevated work platform. That's
it. If there's any festival organisers listening, just give me a call.
We're getting all sorts of different people listen now, actually, which is getting to be a little bit nice. We're getting up towards around the 15 mark in terms of the podcast as well. And, you know, I think we had a total of 100,000 views or listens or something or impression, I don't know, in the last month. Or a month ago or something, so which is getting to be quite a decent amount.
It's good. I've actually, you know, I first sort of came to know you many years ago, but you wouldn't have known me. Just looking at your videos, I think you're doing some work on the Balti Bridge and people were up in arms about whether you're doing it right or how you're doing it, and I was just enjoying the comments.
One of the videos I had an armada of 5-ton excavators hammering off the asphalt on it, and everyone commenting non-stop about how wrong I was. You know, and you sit there and you go, well, it's not my fucking bridge. They asked me to price it this way. And like, you know, they tell me to put 25 5-tons up there. Guess what I'm doing? 25 5-tons. Like, you know, so we're about to finish up. I just got the hand signal. So was there any last thoughts about business, Melbourne, Clennant Hire, what you're doing, how you're doing it, and anything else? Oh, I love putting people on the spot at the very end too, mind you.
Oh, no, look, I think, you know, just go back to what we discussed before, the fundamentals are the same. You know, I think, you know, a big part of our business is set up in terms of what our value proposition is and what our equipment is, and, you know, I really think what sets us apart from large corporate competitors is that we've got real people in our business that, you know, we'll, you know, if you can't pay your bill in 31 days, you give us a call. We're, you know, we're still embody the essence of a family business. And I think that matters. Yeah.
You know, just speaking on that, we were big job, right? Speaking about how important it is, big job we had on the other week. We were emptying quarries of all of their rock. Like, I'm talking emptying them. They fucking have 2,000 tonne on the ground. The 2,000 tonne would be loaded in 3 hours, bang, gone, 4 hours, and then they're done, next quarry. Got on to one of the big corporate quarries, right? Didn't have an account form set up at that specific location on credit card. Bang, put it down. 25 trucks they stopped because the credit card bounced, or we ran $30,000 in a matter of hours on the credit card, and they stopped it and parked up all the trucks. And because there was trucks that were loaded between when, you know, like when it went through, we just had to load more money onto it and make another payment. But then the guy in the finance department, he was on break. And then all of a sudden everything's happening, and then they've parked up all of these trucks. It cost a fortune, you know, overall. And that's, I think, that where people, you know, they actually lean into businesses like yours and mine, big enough to get the job done but still small enough to be able to speak to someone of high enough management to say, mate, I got 20 trucks inside your quarry. Let them run. I'm not running. Like, I've never ran away from a crush rock bill. Yeah. I'm not going to start now. Yeah. You know, like.
Yeah. Mate, I always say a good independent will beat a corporate any day.
Any day of the week. And a big independent beats a lot of corporates. So, all right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jimmy.
No problem. And like, subscribe, comment. All of them, please, thank you, and look forward to the next one. Thank you, Will from Clennant Hire.